Greetings, Rays community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Mark Antonucci, who serves as Senior Vice President for Advancement and Strategy at the Rutgers University Foundation. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Brent.
It's my pleasure. And Mark and I connected in real life and we're riffing on a bunch of topics. And I immediately felt like, how have I not had Mark on the podcast? We got to make this happen. So thank you, Mark. Before we get into some of those current affairs, I would love to learn a little bit more about who you are and your career journey thus far. So why don't you take me back to junior year of high school in the Ocean State, if I'm not mistaken. Tell me about that, Mark, and what led you to Quinnipiac University.
Well, thanks, Brett, and thanks for having me today. Originally from Rhode Island, I had the opportunity to go to school in Rhode Island and then pursued my undergraduate degree in marketing at Quinnipiac. I wanted to stay close, but I didn't want to stay that close. Graduated with a bachelor's in marketing, was involved in student government, worked very closely with the president of the university at the time, was a student trustee, and actually learned higher education through the eyes of my student government experience. Did not even know it was a career opportunity. Graduated, worked in New York City in corporate marketing for a while, and realized that I really had a knack for higher ed, and went to Arizona State University for my graduate work.
Mark, tell me a little bit more just about the student government experience. It sounds like that was pretty formative in shaping your understanding of higher ed, and it sounds like we'll come full circle back to some of that. But just what were some of the highlights of that experience when you think back, key moments or relationships that helped shape your early career?
Well, just being in the room as a student trustee and a member of the board and watching the president and his leadership staff just make decisions for the university and how they were going to guide the future of our lives at Quinnipiac and how they were going to improve our lives and really shape society. That's where I started to realize one of the fun things about working in this field is you actually transform lives and really shape the outcome of society through education. And it was an opportunity for me to learn from some of the top corporate people in the Northeast Corridor who served on the board. I got to meet a lot of interesting folks from Walter Cronkite to Tom Brokaw. And it was just one of those moments of like, am I really here? Is this really happening right now? And one of the things that I learned really early on is the American dream is true. And it's just, you have to go pursue it. And if you put the work and energy into it, it will transform later. Being in student government, you learn how to lose really quickly, because if anybody's run for political office, the first thing you realize is you're not going to win. I did not win my first election as a freshman, but I ended up being student body vice president for 2 years. And I think that grit and determination is where I really learned how to be a more effective leader and now higher education professional. You know, that failure taught me a lot early in my life and has helped me now as a professional and even as a father.
Tell me more about the context in which you're meeting Walter Cronkite or Tom Brokaw. And tell me about, like, why is there even a student trustee in the first place? Because I could see some people look at that and almost like roll their eyes, like, oh, it's, you know, we've got a nice little student who's sort of showing up to sort of go through the motions versus like really having a seat at the table and a voice, which it sounds like you did.
Yeah, I credit that to former President Leahy of Quinnipiac. He really wanted, there was two of us who were on the board, and he really wanted us to weigh in our opinions as to what the decisions were being made, whether it was the new student campus that was being built now hosts, is the home to the hockey team and the senior life experience at Quinnipiac. But also, like, how do we want to redesign the dining hall or some of the facilities? And he said, look, we're making decisions, but we really want to hear your perspective, even though knowing you will not see this in your lifetime as a student. But I just really appreciated his leadership style and the leadership style of the people around the table. If they earnestly wanted to hear what we thought and use what we suggested or said as part of their dialogue and debate. And I actually thought that shared governance approach was really interesting and unique. I always had the hypothesis in my mind that, a bunch of people sit in the room and they make these decisions without really considering the impacts just based on what their vantage point was. But they really wanted to know what the customer wanted and what the student really needed to elevate their experience to help us become better professionals and better people over time when once we left the quadrangle. And so it was those life lessons where they really earnestly wanted to know. And then obviously being in the room with, renowned journalists who asked really good questions, you learn really quickly how brilliant they were in their craft of helping people tell their stories. And I think that's also helped me, especially as now an advancement leader, of understanding how to have alumni and donors tell their story to me and how they can impact Rutgers University or Arizona State or Quinnipiac or wherever I happen to be serving at the time.
I love that story, and I love the way that you framed it around I, as a student, was the customer. They, as the leaders, are shaping the experience to appeal to me and future customers. And I think, I mean, it almost sounds like product management in a software context, which is where I've, built my career, where, there's always this tension between as you develop experience, you develop intuition. And then when new themes like AI emerge, you start to apply that new lens to the current capabilities. And that's part of the job. But on the other hand, if you're doing that in a room without customers present, you're gonna get it wrong. You might get some of it right, but you're gonna get it wrong. And I feel like that is, there's always this tension between, well, we have all this experience, we understand it. But then, how do you constantly go back to, yeah, but how would a regional gift officer on a Thursday morning actually go and do that thing? It's not probably going to be the way that you would think of it. And I feel like that dynamic has to be even more acute with trustees because, especially those who attended the institution, they might feel like they're experts on the institution, but they're experts of the institution 30 years ago, and you're trying to design it for 5 or 10 or 30 years from now. And so, like, I love the way that you described the sort of student voice as customer.
Yeah. I mean, and I've carried that throughout my career in the 20 years I've been in higher ed now. I started in residence life. I started in student affairs. I moved into academic affairs, worked for multiple university presidents. So now in the last 10 years, I've been in advancement and fundraising. But I've always gone back to what does the student want? Are we really serving the student of today? Are we serving the student of tomorrow that we haven't even thought about what they might need or what they might want? And even when I speak with donors and alumni, I'm always trying to talk to them of how would your son or daughter who could potentially attend Rutgers University or X University actually want to consume the institution knowledge and education in the future? And technology obviously has been a big role. I'm a digital native. I'm not ashamed to say that. I'm a millennial, not ashamed to say that either. And I just think that we see the world a lot differently because when I went into the workforce in the early 2000s, we had laptops, we had Palm Pilots, smartphones weren't quite there yet, but it came on scene very quickly and it transformed the way we did business. And I also think that has also changed the way we've gone to education and how our students consume and learn. And I also think, as a dad to young children, they know more now because of the internet and Wikipedia and whatever they're reading digitally that I never had access to. I mean, I would go to the library because my parents were teachers, but on the same scale, a lot of this is now at your fingertips. So if you actually need to know something, you can just look it up. And I think that's one of the dynamic shifts we've had in this field. And I think that's an opportunity that we can capitalize on as we continue to shape and evolve universities for the future of society, and really, what is that next student alumni experience going to look like as we continue to evolve, post-pandemic and into this new decade that's coming?
Well, let's come back to that, but tell me a little bit more now with that context around the first step, the first career step post college, and then how that ultimately led you to reconnecting with higher ed.
So I took the train from Connecticut into New York City. I did it day in and day out. It was a grind. I was living the life that I thought I was going to live as a marketing professional and had an epiphany one day that this is going to be my life for 30 years. I think it's fine if you want to do it. had the opportunity to have lunch with President Leahy and said, you know, how does one get into this world? And he suggested Arizona State University, having known and worked with Michael Crow at Columbia University, and said, you know, you should really consider looking at an institution that's going to push you outside your boundaries. Applied to ASU for my graduate work, and having never stepped in the state of Arizona, got accepted on full scholarship and an employment opportunity, decided to just do it. But not unbeknownst to my parents and my friends, everyone was like, what are you doing? As in, Rhode Islanders don't leave the nest that far. But, you know, went to Arizona State, did my master's degree, was encouraged by senior leadership that were in my courses, that were my professors, to move on and pursue my doctorate. I didn't have that in my plan. Applied, I got in, did my EdD in higher education in 2.5 years. Met my wife and had my children in Arizona, and served ASU really dutifully for 15 years before I headed back east to where I am now at Rutgers. You know, my parents are teachers. I've always been an educator at the core of who I am. I grew up in a classroom on campuses, so it's inevitable that I was going to end up in education. My dean of the business school had even told me that as a freshman. He reminds me of that now when I see him. He's a university president today, but it's just one of those opportunities where I knew that I felt better when I'm around helping people become better at who they are and optimizing themselves and really transforming other people's lives. I think that's what we do in higher ed. I think that's what our donors do when they invest in us. And I really am excited to be in this field now. And you know, like I said, 20 years in higher ed, it's gone by in a snap of a finger. I can't believe it, but you know, I'm just excited for the transformation I was able to drive at Arizona State, and then I'm driving now at Rutgers.
Well, let's talk about that. So you're on this dual track at Arizona State, professionally and academically. Tell me about the professional aspect, and then we'll dive into the academic pursuit.
So I started in student housing. I had no experience in it. Again, I was in student government. I wasn't an RA in college. I was tasked with running residence halls of 1,000 to 5,000 students. I prided myself on.
We should probably have a podcast just for people who've run residence halls, because I bet there are some stories.
There are some stories. It is the best early career experience I think you can have in higher ed, because you literally have to become an expert generalist on the university. You have to manage things you probably never thought you had to manage. And you have to work with all levels of leadership across the university for a variety of reasons. And that was really where I started to make my inroads at ASU professionally, because I
What
was.
were, let me ask you, like, just some of your favorite memories, because I don't think we've had, I mean, we've had almost 200 episodes. I don't think we've had anybody that's really come up the ranks in res life that I can recall right now. So, like, favorite memories, most poignant experiences in the res life world.
I think my favorite memory is I had the athletic director of Arizona State at the time walk into my residence hall. It was a brand new hall that I was assigned to open, 1,000 beds, and he sat in my office. I had no idea who he was at the time, and he says, "We have this new freshman recruit coming in. His name is James Harden, and we need you to make sure that he does not get into trouble. And if there's any issues, to please give me a call." And so you literally realize a campus of 70,000 students becomes really small really quick when the head men's basketball coach at the time is sitting literally in your office as you know, you're a 20-something hall director running a community, saying, "Hey, we this th there's something special about this person," and going from there. The other professional memory that I'll never forget is I had 42 RAs. I had to supervise them all. I had to learn how to make this thing work. We had a, you know, in my mind, I was like, we had 1,000 freshmen, and we had to figure out how to effectively keep everybody safe and healthy and thriving and retain them, because that was an expectation at the time. And we were at that at the time, ASU was washing away the party school mentality, so there was a lot of expectation on us on the ground to really, you know, educate and teach students on there's a right and a wrong way to have the college experience, and that what you thought or saw online is not really what it is, and to cultivate and curate that experience positively. I'm excited to say that in my 5 years in housing, Nobody passed away under my watch. I had that as an achievement goal. But it was just understanding how to supervise 42, 18 to 21-year-olds at the time of, coming from different walks of rice. I had people from international who worked for me, and just understanding how to build a team and how to get the most out of the 42 of us in totality to make sure that the 1,000 that we were serving was having a positive and enjoyable experience in their freshman year at Arizona State. And I think that experience there actually helped me today as a senior vice president, because I literally had to learn on the job how to manage personalities, people, and process in literally in the moment.
Well, and it's such a like reframing that, because everybody, right, listening went through college for the most part, and like can think of their own RA or TA or whatever the equivalent was at the time. But then now, and you speak in commercial terms, you use for-profit language. I'm going to reference some of that in the coming minutes here. But when you think about like that residential RA student relationship, like that is truly at the intersection of the mission of higher education, the mission of Arizona State University, but also the business model. Because you could reframe the whole thing as like, our objective is to retain revenue. And one of the ways we're going to retain revenue is by supporting the students through mentorship, guidance, acclimation, issues, and so forth. And so I guess when you think about like the 42 RAs, you could almost think of them as like account executives or customer success managers, in our world. Like, who was the, not by name, but like what separated the best out of 42 RAs from the least effective out of 42 RAs? And how do you think about that in the context of your work now? Because I bet some of the same characteristics will separate the best gift officers from the worst, for example.
I think the characteristics were really common. One, they had a quest for knowledge. They were always learning, wanting to learn more. They had an insatiable appetite for understanding. They wanted to be coached. They wanted to be mentored. They wanted to be developed. They welcome focused feedback. They failed forward. They weren't afraid to try new different things. They constantly asked questions. They saw themselves as a sum of the team versus the parts, and they felt that they had a calling doing this. The funny thing is, this is a interesting story. One of them, who was my best RA at the time, is now a senior leader in higher education in an advancement shop. Just completed his doctorate in higher
Well,
ed.
now you gotta name names if they're the
Yeah,
best.
so his name is Travis Egbert. He serves as the Deputy Chief of Staff at the ASU Foundation. I've known Travis since he was a freshman from Seattle. He was on my staff for all 3 years, did a variety of things, ended up coming back to ASU to pursue his doctorate. And it's just a journey that you didn't think at the time, and I was in my early 20s, and here's this young kid coming in who really believed in the process, and he got other people to believe. And I still say to this day, Travis is one of those people you want on your team. He's going to make you better, and he's just willing to do anything. And I think that's translatable to how you run an organization today. I mean, I have over 100 colleagues that are in my direct supervision here at Rutgers, and the top performers are just, what can I do? How can I help? Where can I help innovate? And regardless of my role or my title, and I just think it's a service. I mean, I believe if you're in higher education, regardless of what role you play, it's a civil service. I think we serve the greater population. We play different parts at the university, but at the end of the day, when students graduate, in that 4 year span or sooner, or maybe some take five. But I think, as I've said, and I said it on day one when I was at ASU, and I say it today at Rutgers, commencement day is the greatest day on a university campus because we've done our job. Our job is to help that student transform themselves over the 4 years that they're with us and become a better member of society. And if we do that and they graduate with a degree, we should just be proud. That's a heck of an achievement. and you should feel joy. And I think people who come to work every day with that mentality, knowing I'm helping somebody else get better and become something of themselves, I think that just translates in. And you can see that in fundraisers, you can see that in operational professionals, you can see that in even administrative assistants, people who just have that passion for making people better and care about the bigger cause, and it's we over me, I just think is what makes this thing go. And I there's a lot of us in higher ed who still believe this, the fire burns, and I just think we've gotten a rough shake globally right now, but there's a lot of us out there, and I'm sure a lot are listening today, who are probably saying, yeah, he's right. But I think we have to show that more. And I think that's an opportunity that we haven't taken advantage of in the field quite lately in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, it's come up a variety of times. It just feels like we have such a PR problem in higher ed. Yet when you speak, when you witness the transformations on commencement day, or you watch it in your role in Res Life, when you're around the students, there's just so much positivity and so many amazing stories. And those stories are not the ones that make the front page. You know, the front page is the negative or the protest or the student loan or, you know, whatever it may be that gets, you know, that gets clicks. And we have to just counter, you know, now at the same time, like also evaluate, because there's valid criticism and issues and things that need to be improved, but there is so much good being done that is just right now in particular in mid-24 just feels like it's not getting the attention it deserves.
I
Tell
agree.
me
There's
about
more good than bad out there.
sure. Tell me about so you're in Res Life. That feels like a long way away from Chief of Staff of the Foundation and some of the roles that you led there. So what was the conduit into the foundation?
I just needed an opportunity. I had left Arizona for a hot second, and my better half, she was the had an opportunity to come back and work in higher ed at ASU. She still does. And I was just a trailing spouse. And because I was a great networker and I got to know as many people as I could at Arizona State and in the business, people in senior leadership roles were like, we literally need somebody to come in and help drive forward our new senior vice president of principal gifts at the time, and work with the CEO of the foundation at the time on a variety of other duties as assigned. And just because I had worked in Res Life, and I was learning how to be an expert generalist really early in career, and I understood the power of the enterprise of the institution. I don't believe I grew up in a silo. I grew up horizontally versus vertically at ASU, and so I was given an opportunity to step into as a chief of staff and do a variety of things, and then learn fundraising as I went, and got pretty good at it as I kind of worked my way up at the ASU Foundation. Eventually, after doing 6.5 years of service, departing as vice president and chief of staff there to head to Rutgers. But it was just an opportunity. It when you're in the room and you've gotten to know people on a personal level, from the president down to his senior vice presidents at the university, you start to build trust. And I've always taught, I teach my children this, the same thing. If you're consistent and you find ways to contribute, and you put in and you go at it the right way, good things will eventually happen. And it's just that level of consistency and performance that I think they noticed in me and said, he will find a way to get it done. And sure enough, we did.
So let's talk a little bit more about your approach to networking, and it sounds like you're intentional about it. If people are listening to our conversation right now, if they are listening to Raise Podcast and not a thousand other podcasts that they could be listening to, they're doing so because they care and they want to learn, and they want to learn from leaders like you, and they are likely on the spectrum of the ambitious future leaders of this industry. And so what would you say to those individuals as it relates to networking? Because what I heard from you were two themes. One is you have to build those relationships, but two, you have to deliver. But if you just deliver and you aren't as intentional about building the network, and there's always a fine line between, authentically connecting with people and self-promotion, but just tell me how you think about that and what advice you would give, because it's clearly served you really well.
I think the advice I would give, and I say this to everybody I mentor, and I'll always take a call with people if they reach out and want to just learn more. You have to be intentional when you go up to senior leadership or people who are in influential positions, and you have to go in with a strategy. So I'm naturally an introvert, believe it or not. And so I actually prepare myself when I go to conferences or meetings or wherever I'm going to be, and I know there's a collection of people who could, put me on a different trajectory at some point in my career. Even if it's, I'm in the Washington, D.C. and I'm meeting with government officials, you never know where they're going to be in 5 to 10 years. And so I always go in with an intentional strategy of, here's who I am, here's how I can help you, what can I do to help you? How can we mutually find places of agreement and drive things forward, and then following through on it? I'm very, very intentional on, if I shake your hand or I get your business card or scan your LinkedIn now, I'm following up, I'm actually connecting, I'm sending a note of thanks and gratitude just for the handshake. And then if there's something that, and I the other thing is I do research on people that I meet. It might sound crazy, but we have the ability to Google and LinkedIn. And if there's something in somebody's repertoire or their experiences that it's like, well, that's really interesting. I'll literally reach out to them and ask a question. I've prided myself on getting to know a lot of university presidents because I aspire to be one someday. And the question that whenever I have the opportunity to interact with a president of a university, large, small, or in the middle, is how do you manage the job as a parent and as a professional and as a member of the state or whatever the role you're also playing? And it's usually that humbling experience of that question alone of like, how do you do this and be a good dad? I think really, because at the end of the day, my number one job is to be dad to my son and daughter. That's what keeps me going. I think that's what, and if any parents listening, that's why we get up what we do in the morning. And the second thing that gets me going is we get to transform the lives of people. But understanding how to do that balance effectively, people who are in the seat can tell you, hey, I've done this well, I've done that not well, and whatnot. And then the other thing is say what you're gonna do, what you're gonna say. So if you're gonna follow up, follow up. If you're gonna connect them to somebody else, connect them to somebody else. I'm a big believer in we are all in the same business here. And one of the things, especially in advancement, is we know fundraisers move around. We know talent moves around for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's got nothing to do with the job that they're in. It's got to do with the spouse got transferred. And so I'm a big believer of, hey, you're a high performer or you're a great performer for us, and you might be leaving us. And because of my contacts, I'll just say, hey, I'll connect you with the people I know at that institution. I don't know if it's going to go anywhere, but good people should know good people. And so I've always parted ways when I even folks like you, Brent, I've parted ways with saying, hey, if there's anything I can do or anybody I can connect you with, I'll do it. And it might not be in the immediate, but you have to do it over time. And I just think I've been known now, hopefully, that I say what I do, and I follow through on it. And I think anybody who's listening today, you have to take that initial step. And I know for the introverts listening, it's a lot of stress and anxiety, and I've had to refine it over the years. But just what is that 30-second elevator pitch? And then how do you build a connection and have the conversation and move forward, knowing that it might not materialize in the immediate, but it takes time, and allow it to take time. And that's how I've been successful so far in my career.
I love it, Mark. Thank you. There's so much there, and I hope everybody listens to that over and over. And honestly, a ton of it resonates. It's partly why I started this podcast, because I felt like so many of my interactions, as a vendor in the space, where it would start with, "Who are you? What is your job title? Oh, you have 100 people that report to you. What are your goals? What are your issues? Tell me about your CRM, et cetera, et cetera." And there wasn't a lot of space for just like, "Oh, and like, who are you, by the way?" Because ultimately, our job is not that different than the job of a good development officer, for example. And I feel like so many times in this space, you all spend so much time asking other people their stories and hearing their stories and thinking about ways you can help them. And there was never really an outlet to hear your stories. And like, even in this conversation, like you and I met at a conference, we had a nice connection, but I feel like I know you so much more, and we're only 31 minutes in. And it's like such a good reminder of just, yeah, sometimes like looking backwards helps you move forward, you know? So on that note, A, you said out loud that you aspire to be a university president. I love it when people just say that, and you've clearly, you know, said that before, because it rolled off the tongue very naturally. But with that, like, who are some of the presidents that you admire, and why? Like, who are some of the great leaders that, whether you know them directly or have just had a handshake, or maybe just follow through social media or otherwise, like, who are you learning from right now as you think about that aspiration?
Well, I study everybody. I'm not biased. I think you could be running a campus of 3,000 students, or you could be running a campus of 300,000 students. There's value in how everybody leads differently. Obviously, I very closely watch my current president, Jonathan Holloway, who has been managing a lot of challenging situations here at Rutgers over the last 12 to 16 months. He's done it with grace. He's been a gentleman. He's been a very he's been what a diplomat I would imagine. If you look it up in the dictionary, there's probably a photograph of him. And he's done it with an understanding that it's just that's the card he's been dealt, and I'm going to do the best I can. And some of this I can't overcome, and we're going to just try to do our best, and it is what it is, and that's all we can do. And I admire on how he has taken that approach with grace. And he has encouraged his leadership team to operate the same way. Another president, it'd be, you know, obviously I'm a protege of ASU President Mike Locrow. I've worked really closely with him over the years. I've gotten to know him. He's a transformational leader. I just think he thinks differently. He sees the world through a different lens. He is driving, his goal is to educate as many students who can be educated as possible. I share the same passion and perspective as he does. And I just think, like, there's, you know, why not say yes when everybody else is saying no? That's always been my mantra. I developed that while I was at ASU underneath him. I wrote my dissertation on the model he's built at Arizona State, and whatnot. But I've also studied, you know, presidents of the University of California system from back in the days of, you know, when they were transforming the UC system to what it is today. I've studied presidents at the Ivy League schools, at large publics. Obviously, President Gee, who's been in multiple university, has done dynamic things, dynamic fundraiser, really, I think, put advancement on the map from how a president, you know, wrote the book on presidential fundraising and engagement. But you just study different pieces of it. The other thing that I and this is the interesting thing. I was just speaking to a class a couple of weeks ago on higher education leadership, and they asked a similar question. And I says, you know, if I study anybody, I study coaches. I study the coach, you know, Joe Mazzulla of the Boston Celtics, or Bill Belichick of the New England Patriots, or Sean McDermott of the Buffalo Bills, or Brian Snitker of the Atlanta Braves. And what do they do differently, but what do they do the same, and how do they make adjustments? Because I think coaches who are coaching at the highest level, regardless of the sport, they're doing it for a, they're there for one reason. They obviously know how to get the best out of an athlete who is obviously genetically better than the rest of us in some form or fashion, but they're putting them at their optimal level. And if they're winning championships, which a lot of these coaches have been doing, or they're developing Hall of Fame like players, you know, what is it that they're doing to get that optimization? And what are those little adjustments? Because I think as leaders, it's taking those little adjustments psychologically and, you know, from a mentality standpoint and applying some of the same tactics and traits to how we manage our people and how we lead our people. You know, it used to be said that you could, you know, study politicians and, you know, the great presidents. And I read a lot about Lincoln and, you know, Roosevelt and Washington and some of the historical figures who shaped this country. But I also think in the modern times, coaches have become somewhat of that new breed of, you know, what are they doing differently? amidst a lot of change, in their industries. I mean, yes, there's money involved, but that adds a level of pressure. But understanding how do they make their players tick, whether and how do they get them to that next level? I was watching, Olympic trials last night with my daughter, and just watching how the swim coaches are, giving those last minute pep talks to their swimmers before they jump off the blocks. And you think that some of these athletes have been preparing their entire life for this one moment, and they're still coaching them up until the minute before they got to walk out and do that. And I just think, if somebody's trusting you that much with literally your childhood dream, there's something to be learned there.
I could not agree more, but I also have to push back a little bit because I feel like the culture of professional sports that you're describing or elite sports is one of direct, candid, constant feedback and adjustments. And I feel like one of the biggest issues in higher ed is walking on eggshells, people thinking things but not saying. Like the coach doesn't think twice about saying, not this way, Mark, this way. I want to see you do it this, or great job. The way you just did it, do it like that every time, where there's just constant intervention. And I am a coach of my kids' youth football program in Puerto Rico. And it's been an amazing experience for me to do that work. But I think about it myself. I'm like, how is it that I can so quickly interject and correct and adapt in that context, but not always in the professional context? Like, why is that? And do you feel that? Because I was just talking to a higher ed leader the other day, and she was just sharing like truly some specific anecdotes and story that are so counter to your narrative around like every single person in the higher ed enterprise should feel proud on commencement day because of a job well done. It was apathy. And I know that that is an issue that many leaders navigate. So how do you think about like how would Bill Belichick manage an advancement team relative to how we do it, right? It's not a perfect comparison. And obviously when people are getting paid, millions and millions of dollars, there's like a lot there, but I do think there's some common principles of like coaching in an athletic context versus coaching at work.
Well, I think so. My counter is, why not use some of those tactics in the professional space? And
I
I think
agree.
that is probably one of the reasons, I believe, why I have rose through the ranks so quickly, is because I confront the brutal facts. I'm a big Jim Collins guy. But I think if you look at the biggest tech companies in the world, they just have the conversation. They don't dance around it. It is what it is. And then once you've actually put the challenge on the table and addressed the tension, you go from there. And that's actually what I've been doing. And I think that's one of the leadership lessons that I've been, refining over the last 3 to 5 years, especially coming out of COVID. Of one of the things that I tell my teams constantly is, we're going to have open dialogue. We're going to address the tension, and we're going to do it in an immediacy. And if we do those three things and we do it on a consistent basis, we're going to stop being afraid of hurting other people's feelings and actually getting to the root cause. I think, and again, this is just probably maybe my perspective is different from others, is if we keep dancing around it, we're going to continue to self-sabotage ourselves in this business. And we're going to continue to dig our own graves to an extent where we might not be able to get out from underneath it. Higher education is an engine of the economy in the United States. It's one of the reasons why the United States is the world leader, because we have the most educated workforce in the world. And it's because of our universities. And if we think back to everything that's been invented that's transformed society, the university's been at the center of that invention or idea in some form or fashion. Now, yes, Bill Gates left Harvard to build Microsoft out of his garage, but it was birthed at Harvard. Mark Zuckerberg left Harvard to build Facebook, but it was birthed at Harvard. It starts at a university because we allow the ability for knowledge to transfer and to dialogue to happen. But we got to acknowledge that, and we got to allow it to occur, and we got to stop dancing around the brutal facts. And I think when leaders step into the arena, regardless if you're in fundraising, or you're in student affairs, or you're in academic affairs, You have to have the honest conversations. And I think, and I've sat in thousands of meetings throughout my career where it's like, we all know what we want to say, but nobody wants to say it. And whether for better or worse, I'm usually the guy that just says, guys, we all know what we're thinking. Let's just put it on the table and move on. And you've noticed, and this is what I've learned from coaches, you've noticed people's body language changes and people are like, okay, let's actually have the real conversation. Because I know there's a bunch of people who are listening to this podcast today who are saying, well, yeah, there's always a meeting before the meeting and a meeting after the meeting. My philosophy and my leadership style is the meeting is the meeting. Do it in the meeting. And if you're not going to be able to do it in the meeting, then don't have it. And I've actually role modeled this with my division here at Rutgers of we're going to have the conversation. We're not going to have an, let's go down the list and update everybody. We can send everybody an email or a Slack or whatever the new technology is to update everybody on what's going on. When we sit in a room, either virtually or in person, we are talking about integrative ideas. How do we make the thing better? How do we strategize around the donor? How do we integrate the technology to move the fundraising pace setting higher and faster? And how do we actually serve the customer that we're working with who is investing in the university? But you have to, I think leaders need to step up a little bit more. This is just my opinion. And just, confront the brutal facts. But my biggest thing is, and the one lesson that I, learned from the great coach Mike Krzyzewski is you address the tension. Look, it happened. Let's address it. Let's learn from it. Let's talk about it and then move on. I mean, when I took my counseling and psychology classes as a graduate student, that's the first thing they teach you in therapy and counseling is you can't move on or you can't overcome something if you don't confront that you have an issue. And so why not? And there's a lot of PhDs that are smarter than me in this business who have taken those same classes, probably read the same books in their lifetime. Let's confront those facts. And I think that's just, one of the things that I believe we're going to start to see as we transform higher ed over the next 10 years or so. And I also think as leaders of universities start to realize they're going to have these conversations. I mean, they're happening already on the periphery, but they have to become more of the center and just a reality check of if the budget's not there or the finances are not there, we need to make a change and we need to make the adjustment. To do the same thing over and over again and expect the same results is insanity. And I think there's a lot of folks in higher ed who think that works. And for some institutions, it might because of their brand and their prestige. But for a lot of institutions, we have to meet our customers, which is our students and our future students where they are. And that's just the reality to it.
Everybody listening should look Mark up on LinkedIn right now and connect and mention that you heard him on the podcast. But don't just do that. Also, scroll down to his current role and his job description, because I think you've got one of the most clear and bold headlines in your job description of anybody that I can recall meeting in this sector. You are the Senior Vice President for Advancement Strategy, and it says that you in that role, you're leading the implementation phase to strategically increase revenue production through philanthropy, new partnerships, and initiatives to a level in which Rutgers will be performing at scale, generating dollars and engaging alumni annually that will place Rutgers within the top 20 of large public R1 Power 5 universities. Talk about specific, measurable, actionable. You didn't just quickly throw that together. So tell me more about that ambition and what you all are focused on at Rutgers right now.
Well, we are a Big Ten power public university on the East Coast. We've been around since 1766, so we're one of the original colleges. And Rutgers is in the most po one of the most populated states in the country, in New Jersey. And for better or worse, everybody outside of New Jersey sees us as a public Ivy, and within New Jersey, they see us as well. It's Rutgers, fill in the blank. Why not us? I come from that mentality of why not us? I say that to my teams, why not us? Well, such and such school does this and such school that. Well, why can't we do that? We are doing it at scale. We are educating 70,000 plus learners on the ground here at Rutgers University annually. We have two medical schools. We have a huge healthcare operation. We're raising more than a quarter of $1 billion a year. We could be raising more. We will be raising more. But if you don't set the bar higher and saying we can be like fill in the blank, then what are you striving to achieve? And that, I think that's where I get frustrated when I talk to other leaders in higher ed of there's this constant drive to mediocrity because we want to feel it. We want to play it safe. And I get it, but we are tasked with changing society and transforming lives. That's the core mission of what universities do. And then we create invention through knowledge and research. And then we save your life through the clinical trials that we do on our campuses. We're not mediocre. We're not mediocre. We are exceptional. We always have been. That's what has made the United States exceptional. And I think we need to embrace that role that we play. So as a leader, I throw the gauntlet down, per se, to the teams that I lead to saying, we can be number one. Now, we might never raise $1 billion a year or, you know, whatever the proverbial number is or the metric is now, but we can achieve just as high as there. But if you don't set that bar really high, you're never going to get there. I'll give you a quick example. We said that we were really going to focus on engagement this year at Rutgers University. We've engaged over 270,000 alumni through Give, Go, Connect, and Help. We've done it through technology. We're operating somewhat like a tech company to an extent because at scale, we have 600,000 alumni. Obviously, only, you know, 15 to 20,000 of them are going to make a gift annually, but we owe it to those other 500 plus thousand that we have to keep them informed and educated on their alma mater. Whether they had a positive or negative experience, there's still an affinity for Rutgers because they have a degree hanging on their wall and they probably have a magnetic R on their car wherever they are. So we need it's our duty to keep them informed. And so, but we have to do it at scale. And secondly, we have to meet them where they are, and where they are is on their phone. Which is probably where you're listening to this podcast right now. So, you know, we need to adjust and adapt our systems and our approaches to doing that. But I believe, you know, when we set this goal out and we're in the implementation phase, which means we're building towards the next phase, which is going to start in 2026. But our foundation president, Kimberly Hopley, has said, we got to do this in steps and we got to do this in digestible chunks. But you have to set these targets high to get there. And so anybody who's listening today, you know, even if you're at the number one or the number two or the number five, you can still get better. You can still improve. And why not? The other thing is, and I've learned this in my 10 years in advancement, you're working with some of the most prolific people in the world because those are the principal gift donors who are making these transformative gifts. At some point in their career, they had an audacious dream to do something. And then they did it. And that's why they're having the conversation with us to, you know, invest hundreds of millions of dollars in our institutions. So if you don't go to them with the same level of audacity and dream that they have, at some point they're going to be like, well, then why should I invest in you? I mean, I believe, you know, I've always been taught people like winning teams and winners like to talk to winners. So you got to build the operation as a winning franchise, and that's what we're trying to do here at Rutgers. I mean, we've been winning for a long time. The teams that were here before I arrived were doing great things, but why can't we raise $500 million a year? There's no reason why we shouldn't. And if somebody says, here's the reason why based on the data, I'm happy to have that conversation because that's based in reality. But until somebody proves to me mathematically it's impossible, why not take a chance? And who doesn't want to work for an organization that operates like that?
Love it. I love it. And yeah, very clear and competitive. I mean, that's what I'm hearing is I think sometimes there is this reality of like, oh, we're all in higher ed and we're all helping each other. But if you're going to be top 20, that means somebody who's currently top 20 needs to become number 21. And that's good because it means that the whole industry is going to have to level up its game and delivery. And so there is an element of like, we need actually more competition versus it's all a, you know, collaborative family mentality, I think, at times.
I agree.
So you have been at the forefront. You just mentioned technology and you referenced Give, Help, Go, Connect, which I love. you've been at the forefront of this sort of CRM evolution. We don't usually talk too much about technology on this podcast, but I feel like I have to with you here. And in particular, I think we're, you know, in an industry that historically was dominated by Blackbaud and Ellucian, and a whole host of kind of long tail let's call them options. It seems like we're in this real period of acceleration for Salesforce, although it's been this sort of slow build because I think there's still only 10 or 20 institutions that are live from an advancement perspective with Salesforce, but a whole bunch more coming. And I'm sure that means you've gotten a bunch of calls along the way because you have been, I think ASU was one of the first institutions to take an enterprise-wide approach. You're now at Rutgers, where I know you've implemented Salesforce. And I'd love just some real talk around, because I feel like we've also been living through a bit of a Gartner hype cycle period where there, you know, finally was this trigger to shift away from the legacy systems to Salesforce. The hype got really, really high, really fast. And it feels like there's a bit of a trough of disillusionment starting to emerge. And that doesn't mean it's not a great platform, but I'd love just your kind of candid view on like, what's great, what isn't, where you see things going from here, and frankly, how companies like Evertrue and others can help address the overall picture.
Well, I think for large public universities like Rutgers, Arizona State, name the school, every land grant institution in the country, in each state, technology is the new platform. It's just a reality. If you think of, and this is the way I explain it when I'm on the stage for at different tech conferences, you actually start consuming your public institution as an elementary school student. You've gone to a camp, you go to a game, you interact with the arts and sciences, you go visit the labs. You're actually starting to consume your state institution before you're even thinking of going to college. We do not collect that data. We do not build that digital journey. Now, Amazon and Google are building that journey day in and day out. They're tracking where you go. They know where you are in the car. I mean, if you think of it, Google kind of knows just about everything. And with the Apple Watch, if you wear it at night, they even know your sleep patterns. We in higher ed have been a little bit behind the eight ball in a variety of ways. But Salesforce, I think, is one of those platforms where you actually can go end to end. You can start consuming and tracking somebody's journey from the moment that they start consuming the institution as a fourth grader all the way until they're a high school senior who's going on the tour. And if you can start, and I think if universities start embracing the opportunity, and I think advancement has been at the forefront at this for a variety of other reasons, but I think when universities start to adapt and adopt technology as the mainframe instead of having 15 different warehouses or 45 different systems, and it's all one integrated platform like Google. If you think of everything you do with your Google, Gmail, Docs, everything, it's all one alphabet platform. I think what Salesforce can do eventually is, if institutions embrace this, is you actually can start building that consumer journey way before you start thinking of them as potential college students or enrollment students. And then once you've brought them into the institution, they've gone through their institutional experience, you track all that information. I mean, I remember when StarRez came on, and it was a hot new thing in the early 2000s. It's probably not even in existence anymore. I don't know if it is or isn't, but it was a CRM just for residence life. But that never actually plugged into the mainframe Oracle database where the academic advisors or the professors or the, I mean, it was all siloed. I think what Salesforce can do is you can actually see the journey of an individual over their lifetime going up to the university, in through the university, and out of the university. And then we're going to be upskilling for the rest of our lives just with the change of technology and AI and whatever else is coming next. And so universities are going to be at the center of the lifelong learning journey in some form or fashion. So I think a platform like Salesforce, if embraced and implemented quickly, you actually can start to see the results. And I think that's one of the, I give all the credit to my team here at Rutgers. We've done this in record time, 15 months or less, of implementing multiple Salesforce platforms, because again, we want to operate at scale and we want to be one of the top universities. To do that, you need infrastructure and you need to operate like a tech company to an extent, because When you graduate 15,000 students every May, you just can't physically get in front of them all. So you have to build some type of a digital relationship and journey. And I think that's where Salesforce comes from. What would help me even more as an advancement professional is knowing, how you consumed us prior to coming to Rutgers, what you consumed during your time at Rutgers, so that we can build a more segmented journey to get to build around the cause. The new thing in advancement, and I'm sure you know this, Brent, is everybody's going causal based. So just because I graduated from the School of Business doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to give to the School of Business because I might care about education or climate change or health equity or whatever it is that's impacting me in my life in my local community. If I understand that and I can educate you as my end user as to how your university, whether you went here or not, is actually solving the real world problems that are impacting your local community, you're more likely to give and you're more likely to get involved. And so that's where I'm trying to use the technology to say, we're actually solving the problems that are impacting your local town and community, your local state, nationally, and then globally. And here's how you can be part of the process. And I think one of the things that I've learned in my 20 years in higher ed is this generation of graduates, millennials and Gen Zs, is they want to be part of the solution. They want to get involved and they're going to do it through their time and their talent first, and then they're going to bring their treasure in second. But the only way we can get them involved and invest their time and talent is we have to A, communicate to them on their platforms that they're using on what we're doing. And then we have to ask them how they can help us and how they want to be involved. And then I think over time, because at the scale of which we're graduating students, we'll start collecting, we'll start obtaining more gifts. And I think, over time that journey becomes, it's not rocket science. I just think it's, if you think of how Amazon works, or if you think of how Google's working right now and how they're socially norming, we have to operate the same way.
No, it's a clear vision. And I guess my question is now bring us into reality. And when I look over the shoulder of a gift officer today for all of the potential and all of the vision you just laid out, like where are the biggest gaps? Like what are the biggest needs in the advancement technology ecosystem as Salesforce emerges? Or is it all good? Like have all the problems been solved? Just, Salesforce does it all and we're good now.
No, I think there's a couple of challenges. I think fundraising, it was an a predominantly art approach where you have to build the relationship, you have to get to know the person. That still exists today. But I think the influx of data-driven analytics and data intelligence, actually you can be more intentional on who you want to pursue from a major gift standpoint. And I think that's where we haven't figured out the special flavor or the special sauce of moving them from, we know you're interested in this, but how do we do this through technology? How do we get you to the point where there's an ROI for you and for the fund major gift officer to actually have that in-person conversation? I still think, and we do this here at Rutgers, we're still trying to figure it out, but you still have, there's still a aura of we don't know until we have the in-person coffee or the Zoom or the conversation. So that seems to be the gap. And I'm not sure if AI, and my guess is AI is going to be a player in this of how do you actually even get more sophisticated in data intelligence and bringing that forward. The other thing that I think is an opportunity that the technology is going to start to do, we haven't figured this out yet, is how do you build a coalition around the principal gift? And to me, you can close a 7, 8, 9-figure gift, and it's great, and everybody loves those. But I'm starting to, having been in the room with a lot of these, super philanthropists, they want to know, hey, I'm willing to make an investment, and that investment might be 9 figures. But where's the other funding coming? Where's the other fundraising coming from? And how can I build a groundswell? I think people like to be part of winning teams, and I think that's where everybody can be involved. And so your principal gift strategy now has to have a potential annual giving strategy or a strategic solicitation built around it so that, hey, even though we're, starting with the lead gift, you're small. $20 or $5 or $100 actually can, further society. And I think we learned that during COVID, because I haven't met an institution yet that didn't have those significant gifts for the COVID tests on their campus, but then went out and did the for $100, you can buy four tests for, you know, people in your community to make sure that people are getting tested. So how do you go from the high to the low and play in that middle? And I think once we figure that out, and I think it's going to take us about another decade to figure it out, in a combination with the technology, we can really get there.
Well, you earlier talked about just the move towards impact-driven, cause-based fundraising. And so I think what you're highlighting is we have to move away from the thought of one giving pyramid into the reality that there's going to be 100 giving pyramids. And the more segmented we can be with the anchor supporter at the top that then can help build momentum and syndication around that interest deeper into the giving pyramid, that's going to be a lot more compelling than please give before June 30th to the annual fund. And I think obviously that's the tension is that, the more segmented we are, the more work it is, right? Relative to please give before June 30th. But I do think that that is going to be one of the big unlocks with generative AI is that, like, never again should the message that Brent and Mark receive be based on a template. It should be based on our unique history and whatever data breadcrumbs are linked to you versus me, should be able to A, inform the cause that we might most be likely to resonate with, and then B, truly personalize the message, whether it's an actual one-to-one outreach from a fundraiser, or even if it's in a mass marketing context, it should be like hyper personalized. Like we talk about the idea of a segment of one, and it has sort of been a marketing theme historically, but I feel like we actually have that opportunity right now.
I agree.
Cool. Well, we are already at time. I know you've got the next thing to move on to. I wish we could keep going, but before we wrap, are y'all hiring at Rutgers? And we've already talked about LinkedIn, but if people want to be in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, please find me on LinkedIn. We are hiring at Rutgers. We're going to be adding a lot more frontline fundraising positions here at the Rutgers University Foundation over the next 6 to 12 months. We're always looking for great talent. So anybody who really wants to be part of something transformational and at the cutting edge of higher education advancement, you know, please reach out to me and I'll put you in contact with our in-house talent acquisition team. You know, even if it's not right now, I'm always looking to have a conversation. There's a bunch of folks that we brought to Rutgers over the last 2 years that I met, you know, years ago when I was at ASU, and it wasn't the right time or place, but this was the right time or place, and just because the workforce has changed. But if you really want to be part of the way we're going to change higher education advancement, I would encourage anybody to reach out. We'll find the seat. We hire good people here at Rutgers, and we find ways to have you professionally optimize your career path at the Rutgers University Foundation. And thanks for having me today, Brent.
Hey, Mark, thank you, man. Energizing conversation. I wish you the absolute best. Look forward to continuing to get to know you. Can't wait to welcome you back someday as President Antonucci, and hopefully collaborate between now and then. So with that, I will wrap today's episode with Mark Antonucci, who serves as Senior Vice President for Advancement and Strategy at the Rutgers University Foundation. Thanks, Mark, and take care, everybody.